It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Have you seen changes in the dress codes at your job? You're not alone. Many workplaces across industries, especially in office settings, have adopted relaxed policies and guidelines about what employees can wear to work. That includes, for a little while anyway, Congress. Recently, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer made a short-lived change to the U.S. Senate dress code to allow senators to wear pretty much whatever they want on the floor. Republicans in Congress and some Democrats criticized the move, saying the Senate should be a place of professionalism and decorum. Democratic Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania came under particular scrutiny for wearing basketball shorts and hoodies to Capitol Hill. Here's Chris Hayes interviewing Senator Fetterman on MSNBC.
Let me start with the most important matter facing our country at this dire moment, which is the matter of the Senate dress code. Which has recently been changed.
Of course. I've heard that some people are upset about that. And you know, like I said, aren't there more important things we should be talking about rather than if I dress like a slob?
Days after the change, the Senate passed a bipartisan resolution reinstating business attire on the Senate floor. Our next guest is a fashion historian who says a recent trend toward casual wear at work isn't a reason to panic. Fashions come and go, but it does represent an interesting shift in our culture. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is the dress code like where you work? Have standards loosened in recent years? Are you happy about a move to more casual and comfortable work wear in many settings? Or are there places where dressier professional clothes should make a comeback? And you work at a place where there's no choice. You wear the scrubs or the uniform or the safety gear. Are you glad you don't have to think about what to wear? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda Prebyszewski is an associate professor of history at the University of Notre Dame, author of The Lost Art of Dress. Linda, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks, Rob.
Most of us don't work in the U.S. Senate, Linda, but when this story broke, this is a little while back, do you think it was something worth thinking about and paying some attention to?
I was curious as to what the purpose was, because the Senate usually takes itself pretty darn seriously. And then I saw some pictures of Fetterman and I thought, okay, I think I'm against gym shorts in the Capitol.
Now, is this, and I've mentioned a couple times, it seems like more workplaces are getting a little more casual. Do you see that happening? And if so, why?
Well, there was a shift towards what they used to call Casual Friday in, I'm thinking, the late 90s, the early aughts. And the interesting thing was women actually found it annoying because they felt they now needed a third wardrobe. Right. Formal work wardrobe at home with kids, with family, informal wardrobe, and then something in between. But now it's turned into sort of casual Friday all the time, casual every day. This is the thing, though, that I find interesting. It's also casual, even if you would like to dress up. Because there are places like Silicon Valley where there are people who have, quite frankly, enormous amounts of money. And yet they're not supposed to wear the beautifully tailored suit that they can afford, you know, because that's not what they're supposed to be wearing. And I think there are different dress codes, but they might be just as annoying to some people as they were before they got really casual.
Now, there are written dress codes for some businesses, but there are also sort of unwritten rules that people don't necessarily come in knowing. Is that something you've watched for, and how complicated can that make things, especially for somebody who's new in the workforce?
Yeah, it's. I mean, most of the people who kind of try to keep young people aware of what they need to think about tell them you need to do, I teach at college, right? So you have young people going into careers, into offices for the first time. And the usual rule is try to dress a little better than you think you're supposed to, if only so people don't think you're slacking off. And then you sort of look around and you realize, okay, what's appropriate, what's considered appropriate in this particular setting. You know, more creative places, they expect you to be more creative in your dressing, whereas places, usually like financial places, right? They expect you to be more conservative because nobody going into a bank or an investment firm really wants to feel nervous about somebody's appearance.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Kaukauna. Michael, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I remember when I started my career in the professional world, I was required to wear, decent dress slacks, a tie, a dress shirt, and a jacket of some kind. And now I see people in work and church in T-shirts and cut-off jeans with holes in them. I'm going, like, it's gone too far to the casual side. Is how do we strike a balance between the two where people could be comfortable and yet be professional?
Michael, thanks a lot for bringing that up. And Linda, there is a lot of room between, you know, a jacket and tie and those cut-off jeans with holes in them.
Yeah. No, and obviously, being female, I've never been forced to wear a tie against my will. And I do know that there are a fair number of men who simply find the way they fit around the neck to be uncomfortable. But I do think Mike is right that there's got to be a happy medium where, let's put it this way. My rule is, unless you clean garages for a living, you should probably be aiming a little higher than that, simply in order to signal competence to people. And that's one of the things I always think about when I see college students going off to, right, the career fair on campus, is one of the reasons they've put on a suit of some kind or a jacket is that has traditionally been in a way that you said, I'm a person who is competent and in charge of something, and I'm ready to work for you.
Thanks for that call, Michael. We're talking about dress codes at work, whether they exist, how they've changed. Are we getting more casual? Should we get less casual? Linda Prebyszewski is with us, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe what you see at your workplace at 800-642-1234. Linda, I am a guy. I don't love wearing ties. Large Adam's apple doesn't work well for me. But I don't know that guys get a real pity party here. Can you talk about the challenges facing women in trying to decide how to go along with the dress code? It's a little easier for guys in many settings.
No, it is. It's true because, quite frankly, in the early 19th century, this is how far back it goes. There's actually someone who wrote a book called Men in Black. The color options and the decorative options for men narrowed, right? So the color palette got much narrower, much darker, except for playwear. But for serious business wear, right, we got the dark suit. Women have always had a much broader, wider range of clothing available to them. And because culturally, right, fashion has pushed women to expose more flesh and form through their clothing, it's often put them in this awkward situation where they want to be taken seriously as someone working for a living and not someone dating for a living. And yet a lot of the options for women are for dating, right? They're for the big night out. They're not for the office. And it's funny because we really lost, i.e., here's my book, The Lost Art of Dress, a whole set of amazing suit options which existed in the 1950s for women. Where I'm talking, they didn't just look like men's blazers. I actually think women moved into men's blazers in the 70s because they'd forgotten all the amazing options in suits and in what they called dress with jacket looks. But there used to be a very large array of pretty much formal, pretty much covered up, and yet extremely attractive kind of suit options for women. And nowadays it's kind of, I have to say, sometimes it's sort of like every single woman is wearing those pair of black trousers. And you have to realize I love color, I'm a dressmaker, and there are many other options that are dark and serious enough colors, but they're not what I call boring black.
Let's go back to our callers now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I recently had eye surgery, plus many other visits at the Eye Institute here in Milwaukee, which is connected with Frederick Hospital. everybody who examined me using very ultra-sophisticated pieces of instrumentation wore such sloppy clothes that I was very dismayed. Most of the people looked as if they had been brought off the street and given 20 minutes of instruction. And I think that this is because hospitals now have the feeling that all patients get into a panic and get elevated blood pressure if they're treated by somebody wearing a white lab coat and very professional-looking clothing. And so they've gone overboard. And the people who treated me had crumpled T-shirts, stained and dirty jeans, jeans with holes in the knees, just deplorable clothing. And I will never go back there again, because in an effort to calm patients' nerves, they're forcing people who probably would have preferred to have dressed more in a professional manner, but they're forcing them to come to work in overalls. I mean,
I gotcha, Nancy. I hope the recovery is going okay. By the way, Linda, Nancy, not wild about seeing people underdressed in that medical setting.
Well, to me, the part that really dismayed me the most was people who didn't look like they were clean in the medical center. I mean, one of the things that's really obvious if you look historically at nurses and doctors has always been, right, the original outfits were all white, right? And the idea was, man, those things look bleached. They looked really, really clean. They looked really, really hygienic. And then we saw the move to scrubs, where everyone started wearing scrubs. I'm presuming simply because they're more comfortable, but I think I myself would agree that I do want people to at least look really clean if it's in any kind of medical care setting.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nancy. We're talking to Linda Prebyszewski, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. We're talking about the rise of casual clothing in the workplace, when it gets too casual, in your opinion, and what, if anything, it says about society. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you wear to work? If you could wave a wand and change your workplace's dress code, what changes would you make? Do you have no choice about what to wear to work? Because there's a uniform or a scrubs requirement, or you name it. You're glad you don't have to think about what to wear. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up the conversation with fashion historian Linda Prebyszewski about how a lot of workplaces, especially offices, are relaxing their dress codes. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you ever have casual Friday at a workplace? Did you love it or dread it? What do you think? Do you have examples of where people you think are overdressed or underdressed when you encounter them at work? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Dave is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Dave, hello.
Yeah, hi. I was a teacher, and the administrator we had was really big on, if you're going to be a professional, you have to act professional. You should look professional. And it was really interesting. It did garner respect from the students. I think it made a difference. And it's if you can't walk in like a rag doll and expect to get respect from that. And it is a part of the whole picture. And I hated dressing up. I'm a very casual, but it made a difference.
And Dave, in this context, did it mean you wore a suit up in front of the class, or just like nice clothes but short of a suit?
Nice clothes, no jeans. Many of the males, the guys were wearing ties and things like that. I had a non-traditional where it was a possible danger. I did not wear a tie, but I never wore jeans, and it was good. I hated it, but it worked. I think you need to garner respect, and you would look different from the students. You were not them.
Gotcha. Dave, thanks a lot. Linda, this idea that as a teacher or in other settings, we are dressing to set ourselves apart from the people we're encountering in our workday.
Yeah. I mean, when people in the past were taught how to dress, and they literally were taught how to dress, that's what my book is about. One of the things the dress advisor said is, look, when you're out in a public place, and the workplace is one of those places. It's not an intimate setting. It's not where you reveal yourself to people. So in some ways, your clothing needs to be more formal because it's sending the message, hi, we're all here to do something, in particular, work. And the other thing I think of as a teacher is there is an institutional power imbalance, right? And to me, sort of like not having students call me by my first name, the fact that I am not trying to dress like them either is part of it. We're not on the same kind of level institutionally. I'm their professor. And clothing does send a message, as Dave said in his call. And clearly his students got that message.
Dave, thanks for the call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. My senior year at Notre Dame, I was a fireman. I wasn't volunteer, was paid, but we didn't have a uniform. And I told them when I graduated, I wish Notre Dame Fire Department had a uniform. Well, years later, as an alum, suddenly there's a corner in the bookstore where you could get all this Notre Dame Fire Department apparel. And I was like, I wish I had that when I was, you know, doing the job, because I always admired Star Trek. You know, they had a uniform. They were on duty. And I always liked, you know, the military uniform looks really good. I think a person looks sharp when you have a uniform.
Jeff, I'm sorry you didn't get royalties, because that was your idea for that uniform. Thanks for the call, Jeff. Yeah, I mean, uniforms answer a lot of these questions, Linda, for better or worse.
Right, they do. And they also send a message about being a member of something bigger than yourself, right? You're a member of a core. It's funny because very often people will say, well, fashion's for women. Only women care about fashion. And I point out that actually military men feel very strongly about their uniforms. And sometimes it's just because they want their uniforms to function, right? But if you've ever seen the Marines in their dress uniforms, you know they also care about the style of it and how good looking it is as well.
Thanks for the call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. Looking at changing dress codes at work, Linda Prebyszewski stays with us, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. We'll go now to Matt in Waukesha. Matt, hi.
Hello. I was something you hit on just a few moments ago. The idea of this workplace dress code, I think, is a part of a larger public versus private sort of space, which you kind of just mentioned. You know, and it probably comes from a good place of wanting to try to break down some barriers of what, you know, is a stereotype of who's dressing this way and what spaces. But I think it also loses its function, like you said, of you know, kind of, you know, yeah, like the uniform is a great example of that actually too. Like, you know, who is, you know, this, who is the firefighter, who's a paramedic, who is a policeman, if everybody wears a jacket that says that on the back or whatnot, or whether it's teacher, student.
Matt, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. And Linda, that blurring of public private. Well, we had this period where many people in lines of work were working at home. And that may have, how much did that change our thinking about clothing?
I think it did because there were a whole lot of people who did or did not dress. I actually dressed to Zoom classes, so my position was nothing had really changed. Of course, I was trying to reassure, right, a group of undergraduates who was going through one of the most confusing times in their education. But I was also thinking about the fact that I do think there are people who got sick of the not dressing up at all. I think there's a reason why once restaurants opened, people wanted to go out and be in them, and they wanted to go out at night, and they wanted to be able to celebrate. And usually when you actually celebrate some event, you want to wear something special to mark that occasion. So I think, I mean, and to me, the art of dress is actually the ability to dress for everything from, yes, I'm going to clean my garage today or walk my dog or do my gardening too. I am ready for a formal, beautiful event where I get to wear something that's special that I don't get to wear every day.
Thanks for that call. Now, I think sometimes, Linda, when people talk about things like changing dress codes, there can be on the one hand a sense that, okay, society is in decline. Kids today, on the other hand, like from the other end of the spectrum, come on, give it up. Things change, whatever. Where do you fall on that huge spectrum?
Well, I kind of do what the dress advisors of old said, which was I look across all the fashion possibilities, and I choose those that I think best suit my life, and my body and my coloring, and I get to have that choice. And one of the things, too, I think, especially I'm an older woman now, is that I do actually prefer to have an emphasis on dignity rather than an emphasis on following the latest thing, because I've seen a lot of the latest things coming and going. And what was very fashionable in, you know, 1 year, 5 years later was looked at as perfectly silly. So I'd like to pick what actually works for me out of all the possibilities. And then enjoy it. Enjoy it as fashion and enjoy it as clothing.
Linda, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Hey, you're welcome. It was fun to be here.
That's Linda Prebyshevsky, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. She joined us for a look at the recent trend toward more casual dress codes at many workplaces. Hey, one more comment. Frances in Milton wanted to say she thinks business casual could be nice slacks with a nice blouse for women, nice pullover sweater for men. Also, I have a note. She would like to know what Rob is wearing. Well, like every day here, full tuxedo, top hat, tails, my little monocle. No, I am very casual. Radio is a very Rob-friendly profession. Intact, usually blue jeans, black jeans. Today, though, mixing things up, a usual button-up shirt, but untucked. Because that's just how I roll. I kind of stumbled into that. So the height of, am I a slob? I'm looking to Sarah here. No, I'm not a slob, but I'm not, you know, dressed in a suit on any given day or if I can avoid it, any day. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The 24-hour news cycle has become a controversial mainstay of American political life, but TV news hasn't always been this way. In the early days of cable television, there was a lot of optimism about how it could be a force for public participation and democracy. Here's CNN founder Ted Turner announcing the launch of the channel back in 1979.
This news service will be called the Cable News Network, and will program continually updated half-hour segments of national news, business news, sports, and features 24 hours a day. I know that we will succeed, and I pledge to you that we will not let the American public down.
The rise of CNN is just one part of a much bigger story about cable television and how it came to be a dominant force in American politics. Our next guest chronicles that history in her new book, which shows how cable TV in many ways failed to live up to its political promises and ultimately set the stage for the fracturing and polarization we see today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch news programming on cable TV, one network, lots of networks, or do you steer clear of it? Either way, why? Has TV been a big part of your own political identity? Has that changed over the years? Were you around for the early days of the rise of 24-hour cable news channels? How did your political viewing change at that point? Were you ever a big C-SPAN fan? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Catherine Kramer Brownell is an associate professor of history at Purdue University. Her newest book is called 24/7 Politics, Cable Television, and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You trace the technology, the spread of cable TV, going back as far as the late 1940s, which I didn't know. I want to fast forward a little bit to that moment when CNN and around the same time-ish C-SPAN come around. Remind us what the TV news landscape looked like before those big cable networks came along.
Yeah, that's really a transformative moment for the cable industry. C-SPAN launches in 1979 and then CNN the following year. And before that, people got their news on television in, you know, 22 minutes, maybe an hour in a documentary series, but it was very limited. And this was part of the problem. People across the political spectrum could agree that having so little time devoted to informing the public about public affairs meant that they weren't getting the information they needed, that viewpoints were inherently excluded, especially if they are on the far left or the far right of the political spectrum. And so it's this effort to change news coverage that really motivates a diverse range of people to see the possibilities of cable television and having a more expansive dial and having more programs that didn't have to just cater to those half hour or 1 hour time slots.
And now CNN, it's become such an institution. It's hard to think of it as a scrappy underdog, but it and some other parts of the cable content and cable industry really throwing a lot of elbows out there trying to break what they claimed was, in effect, a monopoly of the TV networks. Can you talk about how that played out in the early days?
Yeah, during the 1960s and especially into the 1970s, network broadcast television had a monopoly. It was regulated by the FCC to control and to dominate the television landscape. And initially, cable TV emerged as simply a way to extend the signals of broadcasting to areas that couldn't access them, but because of terrain or distance. And so it really replicated and expanded broadcasting fare. But as frustrations with broadcasting mounted, cable TV operators realized that there is a business opportunity in playing up the limitations of broadcasting and selling cable not as an extension of broadcasting, but as an alternative, as a competitor, which could give more voice to these demands for diversity of perspectives in television.
Yeah, there was a political workshop. You start off the book, actually, in 1984, discussing how broadcasting had failed democracy and how cable could save it. You know, that was the argument from the cable industry. Were there wider hopes from people in the political world and beyond that, yes, this is going to boost our public participation? This is going to make democracy better because we have more sources of information.
I think there absolutely were hopes, and there were many people within the cable industry and activists, many grassroots activists outside of the industry that truly believed that decentralizing information would enhance democracy because it would get so many different viewpoints and different perspectives out there to shape conversations, to shape American culture, but to shape American politics as well. But ultimately, what happens is that this democratic promise really becomes a public relations tool by the cable operators who see that highlighting the problems of democracy and the democratic potential of cable is good for business. It's good for business because it allows them to craft some very effective relationships with elected officials. C-SPAN, for example, is a nonprofit, but the way that Brian Lamb got people, cable operators, to buy into that concept was he understood that he told them that if you want elected officials to know what cable is and to work to invest or to expand its reach, you need to give them a stake in it, to bring cable to Capitol Hill. And that's exactly what C-SPAN ultimately does. And so there's this effort to shape regulatory policies and to really advance more favorable regulations by forging these relationships with the elected officials, but also just making money by selling, getting people to buy in, getting subscribers to buy in, that they can find community and civic participation, and perhaps more importantly, sports and entertainment on the cable dial. So it's a multi-pronged effort that's really about expanding the business of cable television.
Talking to Catherine Kramer Brownell about her new book, 24/7 Politics, Cable Television and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your memories at 800-642-1234. Catherine, you were just talking about how the cable industry was reaching out to politicians. You also cover a lot in the book how politicians started to realize that, hey, these things are changing the game. They're changing our PR, our outreach. What were some of the first shoots of that as people realized what they could do with cable?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So cable does open up TV to new voices. And overwhelmingly, it's those who are frustrated, who are not finding opportunities on network broadcasting programs, that they are turning to cable out of desperation. And so there are a variety of different experimental strategies. One's deployed by some fringe people, especially you see this in the Republican Party in the 1980s, where figures like Newt Gingrich, or a minority, kind of a fringe member of the minority party in Congress at this time. And he's using something like C-SPAN. He's manipulating the camera angle, manipulating coverage to get his ideas out there and to build a national following. He's not using cable to talk to his constituents back in Georgia. He's trying to create conflict on C-SPAN. Frequently and overwhelmingly, initially, this happens to an empty chamber where he's making these grand speeches, making viewers think that he's, you know, calling out opponents and they're scared to challenge him. But in fact, he's talking to an empty chamber. And I think it's an example of kind of the political manipulations and calculations over how to use cable TV are very much at play, with politicians thinking about how they can use it to their political advantage, not necessarily to inform constituents, but to really help them gain more political power.
Let's bring on a caller. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I just try to be careful here with the use of language surrounding what we see nowadays when we say something that's such and such news organization. News would imply something that's factual, perhaps trustworthy, fact-checked, and then more often than not, it is opinion and editorial kind of pointed towards a specific audience than really an unbiased, you know, factual bias of what's going on.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. And an interesting point, Catherine, the blurring that happens over time on cable between news and, as Chris says, opinion and editorial.
Chris is exactly right. And that blurring happens over, you know, really from the 1960s through the 1990s. You have a triumph of that blurring by the 1990s. And part of the reason that becomes blurred is because you have a shift in the idea of the public interest. Increasingly, the public interest, which used to be why upholding this public interest requirement used to be why network broadcast news programs existed as proof that they were serving, they had this civic role. That ultimately fades away as the media landscape becomes deregulated and the consumer interest becomes conflated with the public interest. And then it becomes all about what is going to sell, what's going to get ratings, what's going to generate attention rather than necessarily what is going to inform people about the world around them. There's this really interesting moment I chart in the book where you have Walter Cronkite raising concern about the consumer interest overwhelming the public interest. And one cable operator, John Malone, says, no, the market will demand accuracy and factual information. But I think that we've seen that that's not necessarily what has happened.
Chris, thanks for the call. We're talking to Catherine Kramer Brownell from Purdue University, looking at her new book. It's called 24/7 Politics, Cable Television and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the 24-hour news cycle has been helpful or harmful when it comes to informing the public? Are there any cable channels or programs that you think have been a force for good in American politics at some point? Or do you think it's been mostly negative over the last few decades? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We'll be right back. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with historian Catherine Kramer Brownell about her new book, 24/7 Politics, Cable, Television, and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you there for the major moments in political history that aired on cable TV? Do you remember the switch when cable TV got big, especially in the news? Do you watch any of the big networks now? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Mark is with us in Green Bay. Mark, hi.
How's it going? I was wondering what she thought of how the elimination of the fairness doctrine by Reagan had an effect on this. And then also Fox just got sued by Dominion for $700 million. How will stuff like that keep things like Fox in check?
Mark, thanks for the call. Two big points there, Catherine. First of all, you do in the book talk a lot about the fairness doctrine and its passing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the fairness doctrine is part of that the embrace of deregulation, of the reliance on the marketplace to deliver for democratic debate. And, you know, it's interesting, Mark Fowler, the FCC chair under Reagan, you know, tries to eliminate the fairness doctrine. And, you know, there's a bipartisan coalition that comes together to try to ingrain it in law via legislation. But ultimately, Ronald Reagan vetoes that bill. And again, he relies, he says that we just need to allow ideas to compete in the marketplace. And so the fairness doctrine is really significant for the broadcast industry more broadly. And that's where you see its first ramifications. It allows, it kind of frees broadcasters. Cable operators weren't always regulated by that as well. It was very murky as to whether it applied to cable operators or not. But it allows broadcasters, notably radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh, to kind of really double down on partisanship, double down on some of the tactics that proved really effective, like Newt Gingrich stoking outrage, to do that not just for maybe an hour at the end of the congressional day, but for an entire program nonstop. And so it allows this more partisan programming to tap into, again, the marketplace and to show that it can be very lucrative. And I think that's what you see. You know, Fox News emerges in 1996. It's looking at Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch are looking at Rush Limbaugh. They're looking at how he's able to use these tactics to stir outrage and to make a lot of money. And so that's really the business model behind Fox News. And I think that with the Dominion lawsuit, you see some, you know, this level of accountability that the market had not been able to provide. And so I think that, and it also kind of showed that Fox is pandering to what they think that their TV subscribers want, that they will do anything to try to keep their loyalty. And this, again, is a product of relying on the marketplace to deliver for democracy.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to John now in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to share that one time I asked my 90-year-old father-in-law what was the biggest change that he ever saw in his lifetime. And he said the 24-hour news cycle and all the stress that it caused and all the potential for propaganda that it caused. And I remember being a little boy, probably in second, third grade, probably 1972. And I heard about the communists in Russia and how the little kids were propagandized by state media. And I remember feeling sorry for them. I mean, I truly felt sorry for these kids being propagandized in communist Russia. And today, the free cable media, but study after study shows that over 80% is tilted one way.
John, thanks a lot for the call. John's father-in-law says the 24-hour news cycle, the biggest change he saw in his lifetime. Catherine, you'd make the case it is a pretty big deal.
It really is significant because it's dramatically expanding the information that people have about the world around them. It's really decentralizing the news. And there are some benefits to this. Again, it brings new voices, new perspectives. The network broadcast television newsrooms run, you know, with Walter Cronkite at the center stage, those were incredibly exclusionary. They were elitist. They really did kind of adhere to a perspective of white heterosexual men. And so opening up the news really creates all of these possibilities. But again, it's always driven by the search for profits. Even Ted Turner, that great clip you played at the beginning, where CNN is launching to promise to deliver understanding and peace, Ted Turner wanted to make money. And so he's really finding different ways to do news on the cheap. So he wants to make news the star, is what he says. He doesn't want to pay someone like Walter Cronkite. Well, when there's breaking news, this provides people with access to information. But then what happens when there's not breaking news or there's not a crisis? Then you have the reliance on a lot of this commentary and more opinion-based shows. And that's where, again, to the earlier point, you get the conflating of news and entertainment that can it can really undermine public knowledge.
Talking to Catherine Kramer Brownell about her new book, 24/7 Politics, Cable Television, and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. I want to get to the fragmenting, Catherine, before we run out of time. You talk about in the book the incentive structure for politicians. Instead of trying to give a more general message to reach as much of the public as they can, you see cable changing the incentive to reaching a particular audience with particular messages. How does that change things?
Yeah, so the book really charts that you have this shift from broadcasting, right? Trying to appeal to broad audiences through radio and television. And so someone like Franklin Roosevelt is using the fireside chats to try to build popular support for his programs. And he's, you know, again, circumventing critics to speak directly to audiences. But again, the whole idea is to make his programs more likable. Cable is a little bit different because it relies on more narrow segments and mobilizing very vocal, narrow, smaller segments of the population. It's all about cultivating loyalty, not necessarily likability. Loyalty to individual brands, loyalty to individual lifestyles, infusing that with politics. And so it makes it more about kind of connecting to what is seen as the quote unquote right demographics, those people that'll be more passionate, that'll be more engaged about politics, and not, and kind of eschewing that responsibility of reaching everybody and that desire to build consensus around ideas, candidates, and policies.
And I think a lot of people would point at social media and the internet for doing the things you just said. You move that dial back a lot further with cable TV. That set us up, it seems, for the fragmented politics we have today.
Exactly. I think that the way in which social media has unfolded, this search for, you know, anything that will generate ratings and clicks, and what does that? You can see the business model time and time again shows that getting people angry is what can really motivate that business. It's not necessarily encouraging, an informed conversation or, you know, even a respectful conversation in any capacity. It's really tapping into that kind of cultivating different brands, different identities. And, you know, one of the things that cable introduces is it shows how profitable echo chambers can be. And I think that really is at the root of some of our polarization today in both media and politics.
Catherine, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for the conversation.
That was Catherine Kramer Brownell, Associate Professor of History at Purdue University. We've been talking about her new book. It's called 24/7 Politics, Cable Television, and the Fragmenting of America from Watergate to Fox News. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.